Good evening. Welcome to the New York Public Library. My name is Susan Morgenthau, and it is my honor to serve as a trustee here at the library, as well as a co-chair of the library's council, along with Olga Votis. The council is the sponsor of tonight's program. On behalf of the entire library council, I would like to thank you for being with us for the second annual Mary McConnell Bailey Lecture. Like many of you in the room tonight, Mary was a member of the Conservators. She became a member in 1972, supporting the work of the library modestly but significantly, year after year, attending programs, as well as being a regular visitor at her local branch library on 58th Street. Mary was a retired preschool teacher. She received her degree in early childhood education from Columbia University, and she taught for many years at the St. George Nursery School, which served the families and the middle-class veterans of Stuyvesant Town. Mary knew the importance of public institutions like the library to the lives of all New Yorkers. She knew that access to information, literacy classes, computer classes, summer reading programs, and just a simple library card could change the direction of someone's life. Her stewardship took the form of a quiet participation as a library member. She got to know the rhythms of the research division by attending programs just like this, talking to our amazing staff and our curators and her fellow members. At the time of her death, she bequeathed her half of her estate to the library, $10 million. We never knew. And we, in return, would like to honor her lifelong commitment to advancing knowledge, inspiring learning, and strengthening our communities. All of this adds up to the library's mission statement. As Conservator members, you are a part of Mary's legacy, and your support really does affect the lives of New Yorkers, scholars, and young readers here in our city and now, in fact, around the world. So I would like to offer a sincere thank you for your support. Like Mary's, your contribution will continue to have a lasting and meaningful impact for years to come. I would specifically like to say thank you to Mary's friends who are here and to the Friends of Dickens New York who use the Muhlenberg branch. We thought it was very appropriate for you to all be here tonight. And, of course, with Dr. Gervitz here, we are just very happy to host you. Tonight, you might have also noticed on the tables around you that we have calendars with the Conservator memberships, perks, the programs that we are doing for the rest of the year, and please take these calendars, and if there's anything that appeals to you, let us know. We'd like to have you back. We are so very glad to have Dr. Isaac Gervitz, NYPL's curator since 2000 of the Henry W. and Albert A. Berg Collection with us tonight. The original collection, as many of you know, was presented to the library in 1940, by Dr. Albert Berg in honor of his brother Henry. And today this collection has grown through acquisitions and gifts to include over 200 linear feet of manuscripts and archives, 35,000 printed volumes, pamphlets, broadsides, 10,000 photographs, 5,000 prints and drawings, which cover almost the entire range of English and American literature. Anyone who is familiar with the Berg knows that in the hands of Dr. Gervitz, this collection has come alive for hundreds of scholars. His extraordinary knowledge of virtually every piece of this collection has established him to be as much of a treasure as the collection itself. Dr. Gervitz received both his master's in library science and his PhD in early modern European history from Columbia University. He's the author of I Am With You, Walt Whitman, Leaves of Grass, 1855-2005, as well as curator of the NYPL exhibition of the same title. He has curated the NYPL's exhibitions Victorians, Moderns, and Beats, New in the Berg Collection, 1994 through 2001, Passions Discipline, The History of the Sonnet in the British Isles and America, 2003, and Beatific Soul, Jack Kerouac on the Road, 1957-2007, each accompanied by a volume of the same title, as well as Kerouac at Bat, Fantasy Sports, and The King of the Beats. Dr. Gurvitz co-curated the exhibition Mark Twain, A Skeptic's Progress at the Morgan Library, co-sponsored by the Morgan and the NYPL, and authored a book of the same title. And most recently, he curated the exhibition Edgar Allan Poe, Terror of the Soul at the Morgan. This was also co-sponsored by the Morgan and the NYPL, and we had a lovely conservators event there. He also authored the accompanying volume of the same title. Dr. Gurvitz has curated exhibitions at numerous other libraries and is the author of several accompanying publications. On top of all this, he continues to lecture extensively, as many of you know, on Charles Dickens, Virginia Woolf, and the Beats. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Isaac Gurvitz.
Thank you very much, Susan. Thank you, conservators. And my thanks to all the friends of Mary McConnell for being here, and of course to her memory and to her very generous bequest. I just want to say one thing, Susan, about the archives in Berg. It's 2,000 linear feet, so I don't want 1,800 linear feet to go missing without accounting for them. Welcome, all of you. Thank you. When the question is asked, why are Charles Dickens' novels among the most beloved in the English-speaking world, the usual response is that the characters inhabiting them are so vibrantly alive. Now, this is true enough, but those characters would not live in our imaginations quite so vividly had not Dickens' richness of characterization and psychological insight been joined to the extraordinary voice animating his tales. The words spoken so naturally and convincingly by each character are enfolded in that voice, the warmth and wisdom of which reassures us that, despite life's tragedies, horrors, and injustices, goodness can transform and redeem the individual, and even, to a degree, the world in which we live. Little wonder, then, that Dickens' readers were so eager to see and hear him speak the words that they loved so well. Fortunately, Dickens was an experienced actor, which allowed him to satisfy his readers' desires to witness those beloved characters and their worlds embodied in the person of their creator in public performance. To this end, Dickens created public reading or performance copies of 16 texts containing compressed and edited versions or extracts from 11 of his novels, novellas, and short stories. 13 of these are in the Berg Collection. But the Dickens on the published page was not the Dickens on the public stage, thus the title of our talk, A Tale of Two Dickens. Dickens' journey to the stage as a reader of his own works was not quick or smooth. Public readings of poetry and fiction by poets and novelists were rare in 19th century Britain. Educated opinion held that for a writer to read in person what he had written, and with few exceptions, these writers were he's, certainly to perform the work with exaggerated facial expressions, gestures, and vocal techniques made him ridiculous and demeaned his art. Though prominent authors such as the romantic poet William Taylor Coleridge and the critic William Hazlitt had read in public to critical acclaim, they were lecturing, communicating ideas, not displaying embarrassing emotions. Dickens had, since the late 1830s, given private dramatic readings of his works to small groups of friends and acquaintances. He also produced amateur theatricals, even for the Queen. But he did not give his first public reading performances until the evenings of December 27th, 29th, and 30th, 1853, in Birmingham, a native school for adult education, performing a Christmas carol on the first and third nights, each time before an audience of 2,000. Reviewers noted that he had omitted portions of the published text, but the reading still took more than 3 hours. This was far too long, Dickens realized. And he so set out to create a performance copy for the tale, which we will soon examine. Following the Birmingham program, he read publicly and without charge for various charities, notably those that promoted child welfare and literacy. But the idea of reading his works for profit had attracted him at least as early as 1846, when he suggested the possibility in a letter to his friend and future biographer, John Forster. A great deal of money might possibly be made, Dickens surmised, though he worried that such an action might be, as he put it, infradig, which is to say, beneath his dignity. Forster assured him that indeed his concern was well-founded, warning him that if he carried out his intention, he would damage his reputation as a gentleman, a mortifying prospect for any middle-class Victorian. But the Birmingham audience's enthusiastic reaction to his reading and the success of other charitable performances overcame Dickens' reservations and encouraged him to take to the stage for profit. This he did on April 29, 1858, in London's St. Martin's Hall. He chose The Cricket on the Hearth, one of his Christmas tales, knowing it to be one of his readers' favorites, regardless of the season, though he would perform it publicly on only three other occasions. He was still concerned enough to preface his reading with a defense of the momentous, even revolutionary step that he was about to take. And he assured his audience, "I have satisfied myself that it can involve no possible compromise of the credit and independence of literature." The critics, however, were not satisfied. They were outraged. Dickens, they charged, had cheapened himself and his art, first through the act of public reading itself, though he had done this before, then by charging money for it. But his public flocked to the paid readings, and from the 1858 performance until the last year of his life, he read on average almost three times a month. A Christmas Carol became his second most frequently performed work. The great favorite was the trial scene from Pickwick Papers, but unfortunately that performance copy doesn't survive. When Dickens died in 1870, he had given over 470 public readings, all but 18 for money, with A Christmas Carol having been read at a quarter of the productions. So renowned did he become as a performer that he could not ignore the American public and made plans to conduct a reading tour of America in 1861. This was canceled because of the outbreak of the Civil War. But at the war's conclusion, Dickens revived his plans and on November 8, 1867, set sail from Liverpool to Boston. Though his tour was to have taken him as far west as St. Louis and Chicago, his weak health compelled him to confine his readings to northeastern cities and to Baltimore and Washington, D.C. In 5 months, he gave 75 readings, traveling days at a time through frigid cold in unheated stagecoaches and railway cars. But the hard work was extravagantly rewarded. At the tour's conclusion, he had realized a profit of over £19,000. Had he not insisted on being paid in gold, he would have netted £32,000. To appreciate the value of £19,000 in that period, consider that in 1868 London, an income capable of supporting a small family in middle to upper middle class fashion with a household of 2 to 5 servants ranged from £300 to £1,000. Even Dickens' published writings earned him on average in the final decade of his life, at the height of his popularity, less than £3,000 a year. Clearly, the 5 month American tour had been a success. This was especially true in New York. Nowhere was Dickens more eagerly welcomed. His performance venue was Steinway Hall, which stood on East 14th Street between University Place and Fifth Avenue, and which had been built by the famous piano manufacturer for the display of over 100 pianos. It seated 2,500, and the Dickens engagement was sold out for every reading. The night before the evening of the first reading, lines began forming in the sub-freezing temperature, with thousands of would-be buyers spreading blankets on the snow so that they might sleep as they kept their place in line. By 2 p.m. the next day, all of the tickets for the first four readings had sold out and were being resold by scalpers at enormous markups. $2 tickets were purchased for as much as $26, this at a time when the laborers earned $1 a day. In late January, Dickens returned to New York and gave a reading in Brooklyn at Ward Beecher's Plymouth Congregational Church, chosen because it had the largest seating capacity of any building in that city. To aid him in his dramatic readings, in many of the margins of his performance copies, he wrote words and phrases that would remind him of the tone he should adopt for various passages, such as these in the Christmas Carol volume. Narrative, which probably meant a neutral storytelling voice. Cheerful, as when Bob Cratchit first bids Scrooge Merry Christmas, or cheerful narrative, or tone to cheerful narrative. Then again, up to cheerfulness. Tone to pathos and tone down to pathos suggest a melancholy softness, and stern pathos might be thought of as the voice of a sympathetic judge proclaiming a verdict. Tone to Tiny Tim accompanies the passage in which Bob Cratchit is described as carrying Tiny Tim on his shoulders, and was probably to be recited in a voice similar to the one that Dickens used for Tiny Tim's dialogue. Tone to mystery, and mystery seems self-explanatory, and weird is probably what we would call creepy. Almost all contemporary accounts of Dickens' readings marvel over his ability to transform himself into his characters. A notable dissenter from this view was the 33-year-old Mark Twain, attending the New Year's Eve reading of David Copperfield in Steinway Hall. As a reporter for San Francisco's Alta California, he wrote that he had hoped to be transported by the famed Dickens magic, but he complained, "I was a good deal disappointed in Mr. Dickens' readings. I will go further and say a great deal disappointed." In his irritation, or perhaps envy, Twain mocked even Dickens' brisk entrance onto the stage. He strode straight across the broad stage, heedless of everything, unconscious of everybody, turning neither to the right nor the left, but striding eagerly straight ahead, as if he had seen a girl he knew turn the next corner. Whether or not Dickens performed well that evening, the evidence of the Christmas Carol performance copy shows that Dickens lavished obsessive attention on readying the text for public reading. This is seen not only in the quantity of deleted text, often two or more consecutive pages at a time, but in the care he took to select particular kinds of passages and words for deletion. We find in the performance copy at least four principles that he followed in deleting and rewriting text, which he also applied to other performance copies. First, complex sentences with dependent clauses were either crossed out entirely or rewritten more simply and concisely. Second, phrases that reveal character states of mind were almost always omitted, since Dickens could convey emotion with his voice and gestures. In this category, we should include the deletion of scores of adjectives and adverbs. Third, in many instances, the only explanation for a change is that Dickens felt that he was improving the text, as when he changes the phrase in Scrooge's nephew's defense of Christmas on page 9 from fellow passengers to the grave to fellow travelers, and as when on page 28, in the middle of his account of Scrooge's encounter with Marley's ghost, Dickens changes keeping down his terror to keeping down his horror. Finally, Dickens deleted descriptive passages that create a mood but do little to advance the narrative. In this category, we find some of Dickens' finest writing. The passages that give voice to the emotionally and morally resonant descriptions of London's streets, weather, and varied inhabitants, Scrooge's rooms, as well as much of the dialogue between Scrooge and Marley's ghost and the Christmas spirits, especially Scrooge's pleadings, occasionally colored by mordant wit. This last, sometimes neglected quality of their exchanges not only lays bare the impact on the feisty Scrooge of the Christmas spirit's presence and speech, but adds to those characters a psychological complexity that enhances their functions as archetypes. But Dickens ruthlessly sacrificed most of these passages in the cause of creating a performance text, and as we shall see, in pursuit of another goal as well. To construct the performance copy, Dickens hired a bookbinder to detach the leaves from a copy of the 12th edition, inset them into rectangular windows cut into blank leaves, and then bind the composite leaves between marbled paper boards. The binder then covered the spine and board corners in red pebbled calfskin, probably according to Dickens' specifications, since most of his performance copybooks are bound in this way. The margins of some pages bear evidence of sealing wax and the blank parts of postage stamp sheets. These were the means by which Dickens pasted together leaves, the text of which he had completely deleted. Some pages also bear the stubs of postage stamps, the protruding portions having broken off during use, which Dickens used to mark certain pages so that he might turn to them quickly. Much of what Dickens deleted included most of the marvelous descriptions of London streets and weather, of room interiors, and most problematic from a technical perspective, characters' histories and large portions of narrative and dialogue. In order that the story could unfold coherently, Dickens sometimes had to rewrite deleted passages in abbreviated form and introduce them later than their original place in the narrative so that the story could unfold coherently. But he also faced a psychological challenge. Writers do not like to cross out their best work. And some of these deleted passages represent Dickens at the height of his powers. Perhaps for this reason, he did not perform the radical surgery in a single attempt. We find evidence of at least three editorial excursions through the text, which he began soon after the Birmingham reading in late 1853 and completed by 1858. We know that by the fall of 1857, at his first public reading of any of his works in London, he had reduced the Carol's performance to 2.5 hours, including a 5-minute intermission. By the spring of 1858, the reading had shrunk to 2 hours, and by the fall of that year to just under 1.5 hours, which remained its minimum performance time, though Dickens would occasionally reinflate it to as long as 2 hours if it were the only piece on the program. Anyone who might have attempted to duplicate one of Dickens' readings by following the performance text would have failed. The reason for this is that the amount of text that Dickens would read at a performance depended in large part on his audience's mood, on their willingness to sit for an additional 10 to 30 minutes. Press reviews of his performances of the Carol reveal that the text usually varied, at least a bit, sometimes a great deal, from one evening to the next, though most of the excisions and additions remained constant. Evidence of this of his reading some of the portions deleted in the performance text is also found in the book itself, since within blocks of crossed-out text are excisions and substitutions of words and phrases, sometimes with all of the excisions in the same color ink. This means that Dickens made provision for reading deleted blocks of text should he perceive that his audience would welcome a somewhat longer than usual presentation. In such a case, of course, he would want those passages to have been modified for performance. He would even extemporize, writing to a friend in 1858, how a Sunderland audience made me do such a vast number of new things in the Carol, probably referring as much to dramatic effects as to textual innovations, that it amazed his manager and friends. In an 1861 letter to F.D. Finlay, proprietor of Belfast's Northern Whig newspaper, he explained the relationship of his performance to his public reading copies, writing, "Here, referring to the performance text, it is made, in part physically and in part mentally, and no human being but I myself could hope to follow it." By the early 1860s, though Dickens still brought the Carol performance copy with him to the podium and would open it with a flourish, he would then close it with an equally emphatic gesture before commencing, as if to emphasize, "I, the man who is standing on this stage, am the origin of the world that I am about to recreate before you." Among the performance copies, only A Christmas Carol, The Cricket on the Hearth, and Mrs. Gamp, the character in Martin, famous character from Martin Chuzzlewit, were created by deleting and rewriting passages by hand on the pages of all of a work's published text. For the other performance volumes, he extracted from the published version a series of chapters and occasionally, as in the case of David Copperfield, subjected the extracts to a Reader's Digest style of compression. He then printed the resulting text in two, perhaps three copies, one of which he edited in pen for performance and the other kept safely at home. For the full-length novels, such as Great Expectations, David Copperfield, and Nicholas Nickleby, the latter two of which we will also look at very briefly, he extracted several chapters. Once these edited texts had been printed, he engaged in the kind of deleting and rewriting in pen on the pages of the printed texts according to the principles we find in A Christmas Carol. Early in A Christmas Carol, Dickens gives us a vivid portrait of Scrooge's character, which he also inscribes in his face, and which is made all the more effective in its counterpointing of literary simile and metaphor with conversational idioms. This is the image of Scrooge that stays with the reader throughout the story, and which is fulfilled in Scrooge's every thought and action. Hard and sharp as flint, from which no steel had ever struck out fire, secret and self-contained and solitary as an oyster, the cold within him froze his old features, nipped his pointed nose, shriveled his cheek, stiffened his gait. He carried his own low temperature always about him. He iced his office in the dog days and didn't thaw it 1 degree at Christmas. In short, he was a human refrigerator. But all of this marvelously evocative description Dickens deleted from the performance text. Why? One important reason is that when you need to cut your story by one-third to one-half, you try to keep only the bare-bones narrative, with an occasional grace note of description and narrator's reflection. But Dickens often left out his choicest passages and retained large tracts of more mundane writing. It is instructive to recall the extent to which the cold and obscuring fog dominate A Christmas Carol, both in setting the grim mood and as a metaphor for Scrooge's soul, in which compassion is frozen and blind. Yet Dickens deleted some of the best of these passages from his performances. Near the very beginning of the tale, he introduces us with a shiver-inducing description to the fateful cold, wet, and foggy Christmas Eve night on which Scrooge is painfully transformed. In the performance copy, after telling us it was cold, bleak, biting weather, Dickens shortens foggy withal to foggy, and then crosses out the evocative sights and sounds of people wheezing and stamping their feet and beating their hands against their breasts for warmth, returns to the text for the clock striking three, and then deletes the following masterful passage. It had not been light all day, and candles were flaring in the windows of the neighboring offices like ruddy smears upon the palpable brown air. The fog came pouring in at every chink and keyhole, and was so dense without that although the court was of the narrowest, the houses opposite were mere phantoms. To see the dingy cloud come drooping down, obscuring everything, one might have thought that nature lived hard by and was brewing on a large scale. To deprive oneself of the pleasure of reading such a passage to a large audience must have been hard. One of many of Dickens' remarkable acts of self-discipline in preparing the Carol performance text, a look at a few more examples among scores of such instances will show that they form part of a pattern that was intended not merely to shorten A Christmas Carol, but to change its tone. After Scrooge has rejected with cruel jokes the gentleman who had come to his office asking for a contribution to their charity, Dickens turns his attention outdoors. He contrasts the deepening cold which has seized London with the warmth of the working-class Londoner's Christmas spirit as they enliven the frigid streets with the warmth of their goodness. Meanwhile, the fog and darkness thicken so that people ran about with flaring links, proffering their services to go before horses and carriages and conduct them on their way. That's the top of page 15, the second page there. A bit further down we read, "The cold became intense. In the main street at the corner of the court, some laborers were repairing the gas pipes and had lighted a great fire in a brazier, round which a party of ragged men and boys were gathered, warming their hands and winking their eyes before the blaze in rupture. The water plug behind, left in solitude, its overflowing sullenly congealed and turned to misanthropic ice. The brightness of the shops were holly sprigs and berries crackled in the lamp heat of the windows, made pale faces ruddy as they passed. Foggier yet and colder, piercing, searching, biting cold. Then a boy whose nose is, quote, gnawed and mumbled by the hungry cold as bones are gnawed by dogs, stooped down at Scrooge's keyhole to regale him with a Christmas carol, to which Scrooge responds with fury." Dickens deleted this passage in its entirety. Scores of such deletions seem all the more puzzling when we look at certain expanses of text that remain virtually unchanged. When Scrooge is brought by the ghost to Bob Cratchit's home, barely a line in the episode extending from the lower third of page 97 to 100, 87 to 100 has been touched. We learn, with the narrator's indulgent acknowledgement of the pun's obviousness, that Bob Cratchit earns only 15 bob a week. How Mrs. Cratchit has festooned a cheap dress with sixpence of ribbons. How she sets the table assisted by one of her daughters, also bedecked in ribbons, that the child Peter Cratchit so cutely tries to swallow the corners of his large shirt collar, which he is eager to show off in the fashionable parks, that the two younger Cratchit children shout joyfully in response to the aroma of cooked goose, and as the potatoes bubble, daydream about sage and onion. Then we are served two pages of cheery chit-chat, a page devoted to Tiny Tim's heroic good humor at church, and four more pages from 92 to 95 devoted to food and its consumption. Virtually the entire scene of heartwarming, one might say treacly, domesticity has been left undisturbed. In the published text, this sentimentalized dinner scene is followed and counterbalanced by the scene in which Scrooge... In which Scrooge fearfully begs the ghost to tell him that the ill Tiny Tim will be cured, a request which the ghost responds to by throwing back in Scrooge's face his cruel remark about the starving poor, that their death would benefit society by decreasing the surplus population. The ghost, in one of Dickens' angriest condemnations of arrogant heartlessness, compares Scrooge to, quote, the insect on the leaf, pronouncing on the too much life among his hungry brothers in the dust. Yet Dickens deleted the entire exchange between Scrooge and the ghost. He resumes the scene on page 97, only with Bob Cratchit's toasting Scrooge for making the feast possible. The family drinks the toast, though somewhat morosely, because after all, it is Scrooge. And then it's back to general merriment, composed of equal parts of good-natured teasing, sharing silly stories, happy drinking, and singing. Dickens repeatedly follows the same strategy in Stave 4, as in the scene in which Scrooge is brought to the ghost of Christmas yet to come before the shrouded by the he's brought by the ghost before the shrouded corpse of an unidentified man, one who led a life of such miserly callousness, much like Scrooge's. A few pages later, Scrooge's confrontation with death, with his own mortality, shatters him, as does the sight of a poor family thanking God that the same man whose corpse Scrooge has just stood before and to whom they were unfairly indebted has died. This transformative crisis in Scrooge's journey to redemption, like the traumatic exchange with the ghost of Christmas present about Tiny Tim's poor health, Dickens deleted. Why Dickens cut and kept what he did, lightening the grim shadows and thereby intensifying the sentimental, brighter tones, is a compelling question, because A Christmas Carol is a redemption tale that is propelled not primarily by scenes of redemption, but by an atmosphere of dread and gloom, by the scenes in which the unredeemed Scrooge is stricken with a fear of death, sin, and damnation. Dickens' depictions of the emotional warmth and light that the Christmas spirit brings to London's cold and sooty streets and to its impoverished homes would be little more effective than sentimental set pieces if Dickens' narrator, Scrooge, and the ghosts had not each borne witness and given testimony to the misery, despair, and cruelty against which these golden scenes stand in brave and even, in Dickens' mind, sacred contrast. Dickens' sentimentality has been regretfully and sometimes acidly remarked upon by writers as varied as Longfellow, Wilde, and Huxley. An extreme example was George Bernard Shaw, who in 1909, in a centennial appreciation of Edgar Allan Poe, contrasted Poe's refinement and metaphysical power with Dickens and Thackeray's glorification of sentimentalized domestic bliss. And this is Shaw. The appalling thing about Dickens, the greatest of the Victorians, is that in his novels there is nothing personal to live for except eating, drinking, and pretending to be happily married. Instead of being heir to all the ages, he came into a comparatively small and smutty literary property bequeathed by Smollett and Fielding. The truth is that neither Dickens nor Thackeray would be tolerable were it not that life is an end in itself and a means to nothing but its own perfection. Consequently, any man who describes life vividly will entertain us. One can see Shaw's point without agreeing with it. In the published Christmas Carol, the Christmas cheery passages, though only occasionally animated by Dickens' best writing, nevertheless, for the most part, serve their purpose, which is to reassure the reader by immersion in scenes of domestic happiness, perhaps more effective for celebrating the so-called mundane pleasures, that goodness is a refuge against evil, and may even, as with Scrooge, transform it. But the scenes are affected, and their simple joys are so eagerly welcomed by us, the readers, only because we have been driven into their embrace by the monstrous specter of Scrooge's cold, lonely heart, by the casual cruelty of the money-worshipping society he embodies, and by Scrooge's terror and guilt as he begins to see the suffering that he has inflicted both on himself and on others. When these scenes are omitted or defanged, the result inclines us to recall with some sympathy Shaw's verdict. Dickens' willingness to unbalance the carol's finely modulated rhythm of horror and hope, the call and response of dark and light, could originate only in a motive as compelling to him now in the late 1850s as that which inspired the story's atmosphere of gloom and misery. in 1843. It is hard to escape the conclusion that Dickens went Hollywood, as we might say, for commercial reasons. He probably suspected, perhaps with good reason, that his well-paying audience and reviewers would react more enthusiastically to and be more likely to recommend to their friends a performance that emphasized a work's bright and cheerful scenes rather than its most frightening ones. Evidence of this approach to other performance texts is present in the copies for Nicholas Nickleby, Dickens' third novel, and David Copperfield. Nicholas Nickleby, like several of Dickens' novels, is the tale of a bright, young, impoverished man whose wits, courage, compassion, cheerfulness, and integrity are found to be equal, with the aid of heaping doses of good luck, to the forces of ignorance, cruelty, and greed that assail him as he journeys through life to win the love and success for which he yearns. Appearing in 20 parts from April 1838 to October 1839, Nickleby was first published in book form at the end of 1839, totaling over 600 pages. For a public reading of Nicholas Nickleby, Dickens limited the text to that portion of the book devoted to Nickleby's tenure as a tutor at a dismal Yorkshire school for abandoned and neglected boys. Duthby's Hall, as it is called, is little more than a workhouse run by a corrupt and sadistic headmaster, the aptly named Wackford Squeers, and his equally corrupt and sadistic wife. Together, they beat, starve, and work the boys at foul, oppressive labor, all of which appalls and infuriates the brave, good-hearted Nickleby. The performance copy contains perhaps 5% of chapters 3 through 13, and its content is confined chiefly to the interactions of Nickleby with Squeers and his family. Nickleby witnessing the misery of the boys at the school, Nickleby protecting the childlike eldest boy in the school whom Squeers delights in tormenting, and Nickleby escaping after he beats Squeers. This text Dickens reduced by another 15% in pen on the printed page, also rewriting many pages. The performance copy is distinguished by being one of only a few in which Dickens cut out with scissors or penknife portions of text from a published copy of the work and pasted the clippings over passages of the condensed version and over blank spaces at the end of a chapter, as on pages 16 and 17. The first chapter in the printed performance text ends at the top of page 16, but Dickens changed his mind and began adding excerpts from the balance of the chapter's published text, first copying out passages in pen, and then pasting clippings from the unpublished text onto the pages of the performance copy. As we can see on the first such paste-in, Dickens changed his mind yet again and crossed out what he had pasted in. On page 17, where the heading Chapter 2 was printed in large blanks in a large blank space, Dickens has pasted a clipping of the end of the published version of Chapter 1 and has written Chapter 2 in the margin, where the text of that chapter begins, both in the published text and in the performance copy. As in the Carol performance book, so in Nickleby, Dickens deletes the grimmest, most disturbing passages. The largest deletion in the performance book is the portion that describes the wretchedness of the students at Duthby's Hall, beginning at the bottom of page 19 and ending at the top of page 21. It's too lengthy to read in its entirety here, but excerpts will make the point. Haggard faces, lank and bony figures, children with the countenances of old men, deformities with irons upon their limbs. There were the bleared eye, the hair lip, the crooked foot, and every ugliness or distortion, little faces that ought to have been handsome, darkened with the scowl of sullen, dogged suffering. There was childhood with the light of its eye quenched, its beauty gone, its helplessness alone remaining, lonesome even in their lonesomeness, every strong and healthy feeling flogged and starved down, with every revengeful passion that can fester in swollen hearts, eating its evil way to their core in silence. What an incipient hell was spreading here. One can see why Dickens might have thought that his well-paying audience, who almost certainly had no first-hand experience of such abuse as Dickens described, would not welcome a dramatic reading describing it so graphically. In the David Copperfield performance copy, we find the same strategy for compressing the text as in Nicholas Nickleby, with Dickens extracting for performance non-continuous portions from the published version. Even these extended portions appear in much abbreviated form, which Dickens then further compressed in his own hand in two editorial passes. The first pass resulted in a 2-hour reading, and the second, which Dickens undertook for the American tour, brought the performance time down to an hour and a half. He even changed the sequence of events as presented in the published version in order to meet the dramatic aims of his performance. But what first strikes the reader of the performance copy, and perhaps this was true as well for his first audiences that heard him perform it, is the absence of excerpts describing Copperfield's miserable experience in his stepfather's factory. Dickens famously said that David Copperfield was his favorite of all the novels he had written, and no doubt this was because it was modeled so closely on his own story. Dickens' psyche was forever scarred by the humiliation and harsh treatment he suffered as a 12-year-old working in a boot polish factory to help support his family. For the Copperfield performance copy, Dickens chose to confine the excerpted text to passages which describe the development of the novel's two primary love stories. The first involves Emily, the innocent, adored niece of Copperfield's sailor friend, Mr. Peggotty, and Copperfield's dashing schoolmate, Steerforth, who steals Emily from her fiancé and then abandons her. The second love story stars Copperfield himself and Dora, the sweet but childishly impractical woman whom he marries and lives with somewhat unhappily until her premature death. Excerpting passages from a dozen chapters between 3 and 55 of the published version, Dickens' first two performance copy chapters tell the story of Copperfield bringing Steerforth to Peggotty's house and Copperfield returning to the house alone. The next four performance copy chapters, 3 through 6, alternate between the Copperfield-Dora love story and the Emily saga, ending with excerpts from chapter 55, titled in the published version, The Tempest, and which includes some of the best and most frightening descriptions of a stormy sea written in English, much of which he originally excerpted for the performance copy and then crossed out. The creation of the performance copy's text, which includes printed passages that do not appear in the published version, is complex, and we can't trace its evolution here. As in The Christmas Carol and Nickleby, Dickens crossed out passages, which on reflection he thought might be too unpleasant for performance. We find, for example, that Dickens has crossed out Peggotty's telling Copperfield how he felt when he discovered that Emily had run away with Steerforth. I pray my good and gracious God to kill her, her that is so dear above all things, sooner than let her come in ruin and disgrace. Dickens follows the same strategy when on page 85 he deletes Peggotty's threat against Steerforth. Let him never come write to me. He had originally written and faithfully excerpted, I don't know what I might do to hurt him. But he has crossed it out in the performance copy. This kind of deletion weakens the drama of Peggotty's narrative and turns Peggotty into a kind of plaster saint instead of the rough and compassionate sailor he had originally described. Equally telling is Dickens crossing out in the performance copy some of the most dramatic depictions of the tempest. These are rather frightening. We find here when Copperfield comes to the beach to see a ship floundering in the storm, he described it as who had risen from their beds in the night, fearful of falling chimneys. Some of these told us of great sheets of lead having been ripped off a high church. Others had to tell of country people coming in from neighboring villages who had seen great trees lying torn. The descriptions of the sea are equally fearsome. As the receding waves swept back with a hoarse roar, it seemed to scoop out caves in the beach. Undulating hills were changed to valleys, etc. Several pages later, Dickens, through Copperfield's eyes, compares in this deleted passage the ship in its death throes to a desperate creature driven mad, now nothing but her keel as she sprang wildly over and turned towards the sea. And the reaction of the townspeople is equally fearsome. The agony on shore increased. Men groaned and clasped their hands. Women shrieked and turned away their faces. Some ran wildly up and down, crying for help where no help could be. All of these scenes and descriptions conveying the most intense, disturbing emotions Dickens deleted. They are not sufficient in their length to have added much time to the performance, and in any case, there are many more mundane passages that could have been deleted in their place. But these deletions conform to Dickens' performance strategy of softening the more disturbing aspects of his world. Of his work, rather. F.R. Leavis, the leading critic of the so-called School of New Criticism, which arose in the 1950s, refused for most of his career to consider Dickens a novelist worthy to be included in the English canon. He notoriously claimed, "The adult mind does not, as a rule, find in Dickens a challenge to an unusual and sustained seriousness." He placed Dickens among the ranks of the great literary entertainers, not artists. This was a view that dominated serious literary criticism until as late as the early 1950s. Though few would now make such a claim or deny that an artist may also entertain, we can find in Dickens' performance books the impulse to please, which is the mark of the entertainer, rather than remain faithful to the truth of his creation, no matter how disturbing, which is the mark of the artist. And yet these performance books rightly fascinate us, because regardless of Dickens' motives, these marked up pages bring us in intimate contact with the vital imagination of a great writer and with the good heart of a wise friend and guide as he reworks his art to please us, performing before us on the page. Thank you very much.